Sunstone Theological Society presents Theology as Control, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
In case you don't know where you are, this is the session where Paul Edwards is giving his paper on Theology as Control. And it's my pleasure to introduce Paul and his commentator, Jack Newell. I have a long association with both of these men. I first met Paul Edwards at the Mormon History Association meeting in St. George, Utah in the spring of 1975. Neither of us have any clear recollection of that meeting. It's rather fuzzy. But I do remember our second encounter. The next winter, Boleen Avery and I took our first research trip to collect information for a book we were writing. We spent 2 weeks in Independence, Nauvoo, and then some time in Lamoni, Iowa, where the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has its Graceland College. Paul is a philosopher and historian by trainer, but was the academic vice president of Graceland at that time. Our reputation had preceded us. Paul had heard two things. First, that two girls from the Mormon church were snooping around trying to find information on Emma Smith. And second, that we were jointly preparing a paper to be delivered at the Mormon history meeting in Kirtland that next spring. The latter concerned him more than the former because he was on the program committee and felt some responsibility to the scholarly reputation of that organization. And Val and I were unknown, and our reputation, our only, I remember Maureen Beecher asking Val for a Vita, and she wrote her back and said, housewives don't have Vitas. They have recipes for how to cure colds and bake bread. That's my formal life. Only a couple of months earlier, Paul had been asked to respond to a paper given by two women at the John Whitmer Historical Association, and we'd already heard horror stories of his blasting them for their lack of scholarship in their presentation. One had given sort of the narrative, and the other one had interjected the woman's poems during the whole thing. In an evening gathering at with Graceland faculty and friends, Paul cleared his throat during a lull in the conversation and said, I hear you two are planning to give a paper at the Mormon History Association meeting. We both nodded. And he said, how did the two of you plan to deliver this paper? And I said, I'm going to dress like Emma Smith with fake curls down in front of my hair, and Val's going to dress like Eliza R. Snow and play the violin in the background. Because Paul has a wonderful sense of humor, and because we respect each other as individuals and scholars, we have been warm friends since that time. Paul left the academic life, what year was it, 1982, to accept a position as president of the Temple School, which is the education department of the Reorganized Church. Part of his responsibilities there include the training of ministers and missionaries for the RLDS Church, and to work on the planning committee for the new RLDS temple, which they now, you have an architect at this point, I guess, and those plans are going forward with great speed. He said the most exciting part of that job so far has been being on the temple commissary committee, where they decided whether or not to serve hot dogs and hamburgers in the cafeteria of the new temple. He also served as president of the RLDS, serves as president of the RLDS Church-wide High Priest Quorum, and is president of the Walnut Grove Branch in Independence, Missouri. He's past president of the John Whitmer Historical Association and the Mormon History Association, and he now serves as my vice president in the John Whitmer Historical Association, which is meeting in Nauvoo in September, and you're all welcome to come. Paul has published numerous articles in history and philosophy and the philosophy of religion. He's published in the Herald, the Saints Herald, Dialogue, Sunstone, Journal of Mormon History, and the Western Historical Quarterly, Journal of British Studies, Arizona and the West, and the Harvard Business Review. His books include, and he says this one's from his past life, Fort Wadsworth and the Friendly Santa Sioux, published by South Dakota Press. He's published a history of Graceland College called The Hilltop Where, and he's published several things with Harold House, including Acquiring Faith, Preface to Faith is a Signature Books publication, and Ethics, the Possibility of Moral Choice. He has just finished, and it will be out this fall, a book called The Chief, which is an administrative biography of the third president of the RLDS Church, Fred M. Smith, who is his grandfather. He's currently working with me, co-authoring, on a philosophical and personal biography of Joseph Smith III, who is his great-great-grandfather. His paper today will be Theology as Control. Now, his commentator is Jack Newell, and I have had a longer association with him and a much more intimate association with him. We met in 1962 at Grand Canyon and celebrated this year our 25th wedding anniversary by taking a four-day river trip down the Green River, which we loved. You know that we edited Dialogue together and that he's the Dean of Liberal Education at the University of Utah, and we've lived all over the United States. But I'm going to tell you just a couple of things you don't know about Jack. He knows how to castrate a bull. He knows how to brand a cow. This is a boy that grew up in Dayton, Ohio, I want you to know. He has climbed the Matterhorn. He has been on the mountain rescue team at Glacier National Park, as well as Crater Lake National Park, served as fire crew chiefs there. Most of you know he has four children also. He's also published quite widely in his field. He's the editor of the Review of Higher Education, which is his professional journal, and president of the Association of General and Liberal Studies. His latest book, which is a co-authored work, The History and Thought of History of Thought and Practice in Administration, has just received clearance to be translated into Chinese, which I think is fun and interesting. And he's currently working on a book with Sterling McMurrin called Conversations with Sterling McMurrin, and he will give the commentary. And now I'll turn the time over to Paul.
When the time came to write down what had been composed in my thoughts, I began to wonder if I had not committed an error in selecting my title, perhaps promising too much or suggesting some deep conspiracy. This was not my intention. It is just that something is not right. I refer to the increasing gap between religious activity and belief, between obedience and commitment, between presence and worship. In actuality, the gap between theory and theology, a gap probably neither officially ignored or encouraged, but which seems to be a characteristic of the political and organizational methods of the churches known as Mormon. In this case, the media is very much the message. The media brings disinterest, and the message being that the past is prerequisite to any meaning, that restoration means continuity, not innovation, and that open canon is a gimmick rather than an experience. Like Hamlet of old, I have little to go on with the smell, but the smell is distinctive. It appears whenever I discover correlation rather than confrontation, scenario rather than evangelism, pageant rather than history, denominational discipline rather than dissent. It is strongest in the absence of theological inquiry and historical debate, being most prevalent when answers are given rather than sought, and when religious experience becomes a problem to be solved rather than a mystery to be participated in. As I find myself spending more and more time in the quiet backwaters of history and philosophy, trying to make some sense from my own awkward journey, I have grown uneasy about what is happening, and in the apparent lack of interest in this happening by those who are somewhat hesitantly identified as the theological community. My intention now is to speak only of my uneasiness. I shall try to give some of it a source and perhaps identify some reasons. I will even be so bold as to remind us of a solution. But I am presenting neither illustrations of the crime nor documentations concerning the criminals. The uneasiness and the failures, I suspect, have a lot to do with the manner in which the Mormon movement relates to their belief. Thus, it has to do with both theology and the massive vacuum of theological interest or understanding in Mormonism. I speak in generalities, I know, and of an institution which I see primarily from the RLDS community perspective. But for a moment, remember that this is a theological symposium and thus open to abstract generalizations for their own sake. And for a moment, allow me to draw some conclusions from our common heritage and from the process of osmosis. A generalization is that Mormons are theologically illiterate. With respect to Hearst, who I will credit in a moment, this means that they are not only unable to communicate with each other about their feelings and beliefs, but they are generally out of touch with the religious experiences which are available to them. And, in the long run, are discovering religion to be a matter of loyalty rather than conviction. Interestingly enough, but not all surprising, the church is one of the major reasons for this illiteracy. Their contribution has emerged out of its, that is, the church's desire for security and continuity, centralization, and authority. First, let me affirm I am not suggesting anyone or any sets of someones are doing this with malice of forethought, or that any group sat down and decided to control theological confrontation and thus religious understanding. That would be silly. Conspiracy is far too simple an explanation, and it wouldn't have been too hard to accomplish anyway. No, it's not conspiracy. More likely, it is a gradual drift of persons who have come to see religion as something to be preserved rather than lived, saved rather than sought, defended rather than defined. We must consider, however, that important decisions have been made about theology and ritual and doctrine, which either purposely or serendipitously have controlled variations on Mormon thought. Because it is a question of interest, of intent and of value rather than a question of knowledge for the church, I am inclined to think the problem is more ethical than epistemological. It is epistemological to the extent it is a misconception about knowledge, which in turn has led to a false assumption on which to base our ethical decisions. This increasing gap between presence and worship, the exchange of momentum for myth, has been accomplished. No, accomplishment may be too strong a word, for it suggests a goal has been set. But perhaps we could say it has proceeded by an increase in doctrinal language, legalistic interpretation, and ritual. But most of all, it can be seen in the rise of what I've called non-metaphoric language. According to Paul Tillich, a theological system is supposed to satisfy two basic needs: the statement of truth of the Christian message, and the interpretation of this truth for every new generation. Let me stop there for a moment and emphasize for every new generation. This means, of course, that each new group of persons, be they young or old, new or recommitted, who are facing the questions of their own personal relationship with God. Tillich goes on to say then, quote, "Theology moves back and forth between two poles, the eternal truth of its foundation and the temporal situation in which the eternal truths must be received," unquote. Obviously, there are not many systems that manage to accomplish these two demands, or if that is possible, to balance them in such a manner to keep one from dominating the other. Most find themselves not speaking to the situation in order to preserve their eternal truths, others sacrificing the truths they hold for the sake of the people they serve. Operating on the faith assumption that the gospel message, whatever that might be, is impressive, that's with a capital I, I would suggest that the proper theological stand is confrontational. That is, the confrontation of the message and the values. The power of Mormonism lies in those personal experiences which move human beings, which alter their values and enlighten their souls. It has its primary impact when it's on the forefront of their interface with their own daily lives. Thus, it cannot be encouraged by dogmatism or by ritual, nor by conformity. Centralized doctrinal directives and correlations of thought or inquiry, even of performance rituals, are not suited to the religious experience that Joseph Smith described for us and that we as restorationists have been led to expect. It is not suited because these stated assertions claim that what we have is what is right. The language of revelation and religious experience is metaphorical. For metaphoric statements deal with current knowledge as it relates to that which is held traditionally, by suggesting continuity rather than unity. The metaphorical statement deals with that which transcends and affects us at the deepest level of our existence because it calls us to adjust, to consider, and to articulate. The metaphoric statement deals with that which we do not know how to think about, as if it is like something with which we have had some experience, whereas the ritual statement is presented so that we consider that which we do not know how to think about as if it was the same thing as those things we had already thought about and already codified. Thinking metaphorically means spotting a thread of similarity between two dissimilar objects, one of which is better known than the other, but neither of which determines the truth of or the acceptance of the other. The metaphoric is in continuity with the way we usually think, being equal parts heritage and innovation, whereas the symbolic language is composed of dead metaphors, of sedimentation and solidification of things we have already known. Ritual consists of taking the new and putting it into the categories of the old, whereas metaphor takes the new and attaches it to the stream of our awareness. The event becomes symbolic when the new becomes a part of the old. The event becomes metaphoric when the new harmoniously alters the old. If I were addressing my concerns primarily to a philosophical audience, I would suggest that this move toward ritual, thus to a secure but generally impassionate response to religion, has come about as a result of an epistemological fallacy. A fallacy which emerges from failure to accept this one basic truth. A description of a characteristic may well determine the truth or falsity, but such description cannot determine the value of it. Value is not ascribed by truth. If we are addressing the questions of value of significance, we must recognize that the value of something cannot be resolved simply by reaching an agreement on its characteristics. Therefore, we must conclude that the value of something is not a consequential characteristic entailed by the empirical nature of that thing. Epimenides of Crete once told a group of Greeks that all Cretans are liars. But of course, Epimenides himself was a Cretan. Was Epimenides telling the truth? This incident has become known to philosophers as the liar's paradox. You recognize the problem. If he is telling the truth, then he himself is a liar and cannot be telling the truth. If he is lying, then he speaks truth. Some Cretans do not always lie. All religious folks have to deal with this paradox in one form or another, for the source of most religion, the Bible, must be dealt with in the same fashion. Likewise, the Mormon movement, for the prophet, if he or she includes herself in all universals, becomes like the rest of us. If not, then they cannot be covered by the same universals that they present to us. Were Christ to say to us, all men are sinners, then we would have to challenge his words or his humanity. The proposed solution to this predicament lies in the rules of the double negation. To call a false statement false is another way of calling it true. To call a false statement false is another way of calling it true. This paradox is controlled by realizing that there are two different kinds of conceptual sentences. One in which we use objective language, the language we use to talk about the world we live in, and the other which uses meta-language, or the language used to talk about the language used. We can say the first is true because the language used corresponds to the reality we see and hear and know as the known world. The second, then, is not so much true as it is aesthetic, that is, for its purpose, for it provides value about the first. Generally, it is a confirmation of previous values. Since a sentence cannot itself be objective, that is, it can't be checked against some reality, then the sentence must be meta-linguistic. It reflects that which is true only in the sense that truth emerges from the values we give it, not from some prescribed truth. Going back to Epimenides, we must accept that he was implying that the sentence about lying Cretans simply did not include himself. Our fallacy, then, is the product of meta-language statements pronounced as true and, on the one hand, objective affirmations being presented as evidence of value. Our confrontation arising from our willingness to accept truth as something separate from values or from meaning. Our descriptions about religion are paradoxical statements in which is contained both an empirical reality and a meta-linguistic value. Our history has been the record of affirming that which we cannot prove and that which we affirm is based on our objective rather than on our aesthetic values. We make rituals out of little more than our current organizational convenience. Ritual, as it is presented in our doctrinal response, in our revelatory methodology, and in our increasing liturgy, represents the creation of a controlled environment where the veritables, that is, the accident of life, miracles, inspirations, must be displaced. They are seen as outside the truth precisely because they are felt to be so overwhelmingly present and powerful. For the ritual is the means by which we perform the way things ought to be, in conscious tension to the way things are. The ought-to-be of institutional religion is primarily a matter of administrative convenience. It is a means by which the ritual perfection is remembered in ordinary controlled course of things. Ritual relies for its power on the fact that it is concerned with quite ordinary activities. That which they display are in principle possible occurrences in our daily lives. But for the institutionalized religion, even for the organized, it has even a greater power, for in ritual one avoids the actuality of ordinary response and the acknowledgement of its potential and its inherent dangers, because by making the mundane sacred, the sacred cannot be realized. We know, of course, that there are great Gnostic dimensions to such ritual. For the ritual, and I speak here not only of pageants performed in the name of worship, but doctrinal recitations as replacements for theological inquiry. The ritual provides the means for demonstrating what we think ought to have happened, or been thought, or been experienced. And by this very fact of ritual, rather than everyday action, we demonstrate that we know what the case is, what it means, and how it should be responded to. The spokesperson for such a ritual, like the non-swimmer working as a lifeguard, are unable to sense the significance because they are so busy with the discipline. A more observable side effect of this Gnostic assumption is that much of the dance is gone. The joy of religious discovery has been replaced by the peace of a riskless community. More and more our meetings become solemn assemblies, less reflections of the joy and the excitement of the people who are experiencing the love of God in their lives. it would be impossible today for us to share the consuming joy experienced at the dedication of the Kirtland Temple, or on the other hand, the sharp passions of the fight for the presidency and the post-martyrdom. We are more like persons commemorating the memory of those who, at some distant experience, felt what we wish now we could have felt. What a betrayal of young Joseph for us to be afraid to cry, to risk, to emote, to sing hallelujah. The presence of procedure-turned-ritual provides the occasion for rationalization about what should have been done but was not done. It commemorates what ought to have taken place but did not. From this perspective, ritual serves not only to limit the ordinary, but becomes the magical expression of our desired ends, and just as easily becomes the memory of anticipated outcome. The ritual is the means by which the non-combatant celebrates the victory of a war not yet fought. Let me fulfill my promise to return to theological illiteracy. E.D. Hurst Jr. has made quite a stir in educational circles with his book on cultural literacy. In it, he states that young persons today have not been taught enough information about their culture or their heritage or their environmental frame of reference to be able to communicate their commonness. Perhaps even more important, they have not learned about the importance of culture itself. He uses the illustration of a stranger asking direction and asks us to think carefully about how differently we explain direction to the stranger than we do to a person who is familiar with the environment. We seek a common ground before we proceed. A cultural environment is necessary to understand because such literacy is the standard communication through which we transmit common understandings and assumptions. He lists some 5,000 ideas and phrases and names that have been known sometimes for hundreds of years and now suddenly are unknown, cutting us not only off from those of any previous generation, but from any form of our own heritage. Phrases like flash in the pan or getting blood out of a turnip. The lack of such culture, of course, even denies us the balm of history when it comes to our disagreements. That is, if we do not understand the passion out of which this movement grew, the heated and almost violent nature of our emerging debates, then one is inclined to believe that disagreement is destructive, that argument is impolite. I would suggest that what Hurst has to say about the educational level of the country is also true about the Mormon movement. Time, effort, funds directed to organizational construction, administrative developments, in-house communication, etc., all take the place of efforts to maintain the understanding of what it means to be a people of God in the Mormon movement. The lack of any cultural knowledge about history or theology or doctrine has emerged from the emphasis on centralization of decision-making, the simplification of ritual, the unity of diversity, all which has had the effect of making it harder and harder for us to communicate and thus easier and more necessary for us to be obedient. I am not interested here in pulling my blunted roller tiller once more through these grounds well sifted, so I will simply state my assertions and leave their argumentations for your consideration. First, the Mormon movement, of which the LDS and the RLDS are the most obvious examples, have not encouraged any of the things that provoke in-depth religious consideration. They are not interested in history as diversified memory and narrative, or in prophecy in the Old Testament manner. Two, the institutions have been more interested in promoting belief than they have been in consideration of belief in. Thus, necessarily have been more interested in tests of belief than evidence of investigation. They are not interested in internal dissent and are more concerned with unilateral assumptions than with the pluralism sometimes espoused.
This is the end of this cassette.
First, to avoid legal difficulty, then to avoid theological pitfalls, since there are no such theologians serving in the same manner. The first presidency, the final theological authority of both churches, are of necessity more involved in maintaining the status quo theologically than either investigating or systematized. What is more, both organizations, my assumptions continue, are skeptical of lay theologians and are highly critical of, thus do not encourage through publication, theological investigations or points of view. Rather, both organizations have increasingly ritualized the process and the message of revelation, of doctrine, and of history. Three, the cultural illiteracy of which I speak denies us a common experience or conviction, or more important, conviction, or for more of us, reconviction. The contemporary obedience to the known, the acting out of the story of past conversion, denies us the common experience of the new affection of a religious understanding born from the death of the old. The promise of our culture is that from within doubt comes conviction. From within inquiry comes understanding. From within the community can be found the evidence of the difference it makes. Being so illiterate, we are in a position where canon is ritually addressed and where meaning, interpretation, and applications have been provided by procedure. The presence of what Jonathan Z. Smith has called tribal theologians has long been the basis by which rivals have maintained debate between exegetes and exegetical systems in efforts to prevent the manipulation of a closed canon system. The basis of Joseph Smith's thought about religion was that the canon be open, that God spoke to each and every generation. But in effect, its openness is limited by the illiteracy of the member. For when the masses ask questions, the tendency is to answer the question. This is true both because it seems necessary to keep the masses satisfied and because it is necessary to give the impression that we, the leaders, know the answers. But to provide such answers is to inject the past, the tradition, and be accepted by virtue of the terminology of organization. In so doing, we determine the outcome and the response. We are seemingly unable, or perhaps only unwilling, to move beyond this. Goff once defined sin as what it is that we do that we cannot stop doing. In this way, addiction is a sin because it is a capitulation to the tyranny of a false, idolatrous desire. In such addiction, we are flooded with demands, we are programmed for response, recognizing that perhaps there is no connection between stimulant and response. It promises a satisfaction that it does not, in fact, cannot deliver. What would a response look like if we were to locate one? Obviously, the theological enterprise must be involved somehow. Perhaps the word should be restored because such considerations had been available during those years prior to our gaining respectability. The presence of such an effort, theological, is not necessary because the confrontation of theological issues will provide final answers. This, of course, is not the purpose, but because the process is one of the few ways persons have discovered to bring the presence of the divine questions into the hearts and minds where we live them, to make the issue of our ritual alive and ordinary and daily. For religious belief is not an assent to the propositional truths that require explanation and justification of such truths, certainly not in truth to be announced or defined or ritualized or defended. Belief, particularly Christian belief, is not intellectual. It is prescriptive, that is, metaphorical. Thus, it is not justified in rational arguments, nor were the matter in ritual or in faith-promoting stories or language. Rather, such prospective beliefs are built upon foundations composed of ultimate assertions about reality and then structured through understanding and wisdom and insights, all arrive through daily confrontations with God. It has been quite generally held that one of the tests of the validity of new revelation lies within its agreement with the truths previously held. I suppose it is breaking new ground, perhaps only restoring old ground, to suggest that the best test of truth is that it stands in comparative disunity with that which was previously held or understood. Joseph himself was the perfect example of this. And in both the LDS and RLDS tradition, leaders and prophets have agreed in principle that all knowledge, quote, shall be evaluated and subjected to further interpretation. This requisite has always been present. It's in the DNC 147. Briefly, the religious understanding we seek is not concerned with constant beliefs justified by appeals to evidence that all can find believable, but rather by prescriptive beliefs about life, which are justified only through an appeal to impressive experience. The key is this: religious beliefs are not beliefs that certain propositions about God are true. It is belief in God, having faith in Him and living by those truths. The Mormon presentation provides responses, tests, even rituals, but in doing so further separates us from the belief in. In two previous presentations to Sunstone Theological Symposium, I've addressed the question of the ethics of prophecy and the ethics of dissent. In the first, I expressed concern over the prophet who is also manager, and for whom the question of organizational necessity interferes with the demands of prophetic honesty. In the second, I voiced my concern that the identification of the dissenter is dependent upon the solidification of the movement, and warned against such identification. In these brief comments, I have been concerned with a third of the ethical questions, that of granting religious significance to organizational events, of making ritual from the ordinary, and dealing with inquest as violation. Certainly the idea that persons or institutions arrive at truth is a misconception. It obviously is a misinterpretation of what Joseph Smith tried to formalize in the creation of a church. To control by virtue of codifying the terminology, to direct by virtue of dictating the ritual, to promote the having of religious knowledge rather than the seeking of religious experience, takes the church out of the business of representing Christ, and as such, is of no interest to honest Christians. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Paul Edwards has brought us face to face with our common plight, both LDS and RLDS. Pre-cooked theology and prepackaged religion have about as much flavor as McDonald's hamburgers. In the modern church, we enjoy the security of knowing that wherever we go, the Mormon experience will be as nearly the same as our elders can make it, standardized worldwide, bright and punctual, no surprises. But what kind of a God would create McDonald's? For most of us, I suppose, our personal response to what Paul aptly describes as the well-managed state of religious affairs parallels our primal instincts when driving hungrily through a strange town far from home. If you feel a distinct sense of comfort when those golden arches loom into view and you begin to salivate, then you probably like your religion about the way you're getting it. But if you whip right past McDonald's in search of a place with local color, any eating place that reflects the distinctive people who live there, then I'm here to tell you that you are an imperiled Latter-day Saint. And pray tell, if you prefer to stop at Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery for cold cuts, French bread, and fruit so that you can picnic in a nearby park, look out. I make this point quite seriously. We live in a society of franchise chains, from 7-Elevens to Kmarts, and homogenized media where every news commentator looks and talks very much alike, and processed foods that never rot and seldom delight. The kids who cook and serve at McDonald's are cheerful and efficient, but they make no decisions. The orange juice is hermetically sealed in 6.5-ounce cups in Tuscaloosa, and the patties are pressed in batches of 10,000 by machines in Tougaloo. The OJ is cooled to 43 degrees, and the burgers are cooked for 2 minutes and 35 seconds on a computerized grill. The young labor force learns nothing about cooking, has no vent for creativity, but they are schooled extensively in public relations. And everywhere we go, a new set of golden arches pierces the sky. Now in Park City and Richfield, tomorrow in Scipio and Escalante. The church reflects and is part of this franchised, sanitized, and standardized American culture. Answers to life's overarching questions are pressed in batches of 10 million in Salt Lake City and Independence and dispatched to the hungry consumer members by computerized mail. Conference speakers are schooled to look and sound alike. PR is always on their minds, and our theology, pre-processed and pre-packaged, so as to keep forever, never rots, and seldom delights. And Mormondom look alike maroon brick chapels with low buff roofs spring up in every town and city, with their welded water pipe steeples piercing the sky. Church life fits American life. But I like my bread and cheese in the park when I travel, or perhaps a stop at the sidetrack cafe. The trouble is, I don't fit American culture as it is evolving today in many respects, and neither, I suppose, do a lot of you. Billions of us seek the unexpected, love the spontaneous, and need a good irreverent laugh from time to time. We don't want our spiritual habitat to be climate-controlled, doused with pesticides, or posted with no hunting and trespassing signs. We live more happily without blinders, grab our boots and take to the high country when given half a chance, and revel in the night under the stars, rocks, mosquitoes, and all. I may pick up a fast meal of the McDonald's franchise before I drive up the canyon, but who would go there with good friends for dinner? What kind of a God would give us McDonald's? My point, like Paul's, is that the packaging of our religion does violence to its very nature. The Lord has not given us McDonald's. Religious experience should not and ultimately cannot be defined and controlled from headquarters. Ironically, nothing is more man-made than the mass-produced franchise on every corner, and few things are more natural or divine than the park. But here we ponder the problem of institutionalized religion, and we join the well-traveled highway with vistas all too familiar to the Sunstone crowd. So let us turn off and pursue a seldom-trodden path again hinted by Paul Edwards' comments. Clearly many saints enjoy an uncomplicated happiness in the controlled environment provided by the church. Their collar does not chafe. My interest here, however, is with those on whom it does chafe, and the degree to which it controls even as it chafes. Since leaving the editorship of Dialogue just a year ago, I have taken a sabbatical from Mormon theology, Mormon issues, and Mormon literature of all kinds. I was surfeited with things LDS and RLDS, as our parting interview no doubt revealed, and I was eager to immerse myself in other books, other issues, and larger matters. It has been a wonderful year, and I don't, of course, intend to declare this hiatus over with, nor do I, for that matter, need to continue my splendid isolation from the Dialogue Sunstone community. But editing Dialogue did sober me as I became increasingly aware of the extent to which church claims a high degree of lifetime control over the very people who seek that this will not be the case. Put differently, many seem to eschew a life of Mormon orthodoxy only to embrace a life preoccupied with Mormon issues. In either case, the church remains at the center of one's attention, and the world beyond our theology and customs remains largely beyond our grasp. So what of this oblique theological control over those who bravely claim independence? For one person, it takes the form of perpetual grousing from the sidelines. For another, we observe a veritable stupor of thought from which the individual is unable to extricate himself or herself. The man who tirelessly jousts windmills with crusading letters. The woman who can't decide whether or not to administer a blessing to her infant child until the kid has grown up and the issue is moot. I'm here to suggest that this sort of control by default is unhealthy, both for the individual and for those in the vicinity. For me, at least, it seems much healthier to resolve one's overriding issues, one way or the other, in timely fashion and get on with life. This is not to advocate an unexamined life, far from it, but simply to propose that intermittent engagement, lending to clear decisions, is much healthier than constant preoccupation and unending ambiguity. And we can remind ourselves that few decisions are irrevocable. It is better to do willingly what we do and know a few alternatives than to proceed cynically in old ruts. Nothing kills the mind and saps the spirit quite like cynicism. It may be the ultimate unwelcome control. I am increasingly convinced that civilization and even life on this earth is in grave danger. Billions cry out each day in hunger and fear and loneliness. We are exhausting the resources of our little planet. People as blessed as Latter-day Saints living in America, centered in Independence and Salt Lake City and elsewhere, and other developed countries can't afford narrow vision or passivity in matters of public concern. Our brash theology and obvious energy should place us at the forefront of those seeking solutions to homelessness, to terrorism, and the degradation of the biosphere. Politics needs us. The children need us, and not just our own. The earth needs us, and peace needs our help. The church even needs us. Our theology should free us to serve rather than bind us within ourselves. Thanks, Paul, for helping to bring a few things into focus. And may we worship freely in our churches, in the trenches, and on the mountaintops.
We have just a couple of minutes for questions. Let me say that this session has been sponsored by the John Whitmer Historical Association. And if you will direct your questions to Paul or Jack, and if you will repeat the question since this session is being taped, that will be helpful. You hope it is.
Is working toward my expulsion. Someday I'd like it to be a book. Yeah, at the moment, they're just voices in the wilderness. Yes, ma'am. Let me tell you how I am, and Jack jerked, so I think maybe he had something he wanted to... Oh, repeat the question? Yeah, repeat the question, will you? She said that she thought that the Mormon Church, if I understand your statement, did not have a great deal of ritual, and that it was kind of getting a bad rap in that sense, and you wanted a definition of what I meant by ritual. Is that fairly close to the question? Well, I think you have a ritual. Every once in a while I get up my nerve and I go to one of your services. And I say get up my nerve because the thing that most astounds me is how much like ours they are. And that's scary. Your services are rituals. Our services are rituals. Who's going to do what may change from week to week or month to month. And whether they will start off their discussion with the theme, that may change from month to month. But the actions are basically ritual. Almost anybody could be plugged into the pageant. Story would come out the same. What I guess I'm trying to suggest is that in doing that, in making not only the worship service, the sacrament service, Levi's comments last night were incredible in the sense that that has altered my view of the ritual of the sacrament service. But I think what happens is those things become so much a pageant that they've lost any power to lift me from the ordinary world that I lived in when I came there. And I think those rituals include Sunday school lessons, choir practices, priesthood meetings, the works. I mean, you could, in our church, like a soap opera. If you phase out in 1 year and go be a Baptist for 3 years and come back, you don't even know you're gone. I mean, they're doing exactly the same thing. Different people are doing them, but they're doing basically the same thing. Jack, do you want to come in? Does that help any? Push it if you want to a bit. Yeah, I rest my case. Yeah, I think so. And I realize there are people, many people, who would define ritual in a much more positive way. I guess I've gotten in the habit of using it to describe any attempt to make into a moot action something which originated out of passion. And any time you do something designed to kill passion, you kill religion. And yes, in that sense, I feel very vague about it. Yes, ma'am. I agree with you. At the risk of being even more weird than I am, it seems to me that dance, and I use dance because it's one of the things that we frown on the most, that religious dance, for example, religious interpretation, anything which appears to be out of the proper framework, loses any power to initiate a new way of looking at something. I think you can have new and original and very stimulating prayers. Fortunately, we have them as well. But they're always new and stimulating within this framework. And it takes, to me anyway, it takes someone caught up in the new affection. By that I mean the new conversion. To be today being converted in a way you weren't yesterday. To shed a part of that old and to be excited in that new. What Chesterton used to call the new affection. And it's the same way you feel when you meet a new boyfriend. It's never the same 10 years later. Those 2 or 3 days when you just met them, it just dawns on you how important they are. You can't repeat that experience unless with another new experience. And religion has traditionally been a series of those conversions. But somewhere along the line, we stopped and said, hey, remember how good it was yesterday? Remember how good it was 3 days ago? Now we're saying, remember how good it was 150 years ago? Just once, let's do it now. And it's possible. But I don't think we've done. But I was wrong once before. It's been centuries. Thank you. Then you can sit down. Oh. Okay. Well, nothing, I think, works as well as success. And I guess I would suggest that the way to have the biggest impact is for the church to discover that your particular set of people are worshiping rather than performing. And I think, yes, chances are you'll be excommunicated in the process. And if you're interested, we have room in my congregation. But you won't last there long either. No, I don't know the answer to that. I suspect, I guess I feel in my heart that the answer to that is to go back to this business of literacy. I think we need to be in the process of teaching young people that doubt is probably the most significant religious tool that human beings can have. And serendipity, using its proper sense, the sense of discovering new and imaginative things from old and common and ordinary, is a tool that can be taught. It can be learned. But it's going to have to start, I think, with the young people. Yes, ma'am. I'll go to you. Well, I guess the one way to deal with McDonald's is to stop eating McDonald's. And obviously, the one... Stop me if I'm going too far here. See, me, the obvious way to deal with an organization that will not let you teach what you want to is to teach it anyway. I mean, it's your organization, not theirs. It's our church. We forget that sometimes. It's our charity, not anybody else's. Nobody gave God to them. God belongs with us. It's our church. And if we cannot learn to worship in that church, and if they, whoever they are, do not want us to worship in that church, then we're in the wrong church. And like, you know, Thoreau says, when there's so many of you in jail they can't afford to feed you, they'll change the law. They will. Time to quit. I said too much. Time to quit.
Thank you all.
This is the end of this cassette.